Just out of curiosity, how many of you here tonight have been to a creation talk before? Okay, good. I kind of figured that whenever I walked in here. So what I'm going to do is tell you from the start that there is material tonight here that you will have seen before. But what I've kind of tried to do is take it from a slightly different angle and give you a bit more background to some of the information. Some of the information here tonight you will not have seen before, as it's brand new to me and it's brand new to you. And I think you'll maybe find it a bit interesting too. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take the watch off because I've been told I can speak for as long as I want. I'm going to put it in my pocket. That's not that reason. I just don't like wearing my watch when I'm talking. So without further ado, let me explain a bit more about who I am, in case you don't know, and the organisation I work for. So I work for Creation Ministries International. It's a worldwide organisation, and it speaks to Christians about how to more effectively engage with a culture in relation to creation and evolution. It gives you more of a rationale about how to defend your faith more logically. And just in case you're not a Christian here tonight, it's to remove obstacles in relation to what you may know or think you know about the earth around you in relation to the evolutionary theory, which is so prominent in our Western society. I'm a Christian. I believe the Bible is true right from the very first verse right to the very last verse, and that is my presupposition of where I'm coming from tonight. And I find a commandment in 1 Peter 3:15, which says, always be prepared to give an answer to everyone who asks you to give the reason for the hope that you have. And of course, my reason, my hope, is found in Jesus, my Lord and my Saviour. I find out more about him in the Bible, God's Word sitting here beside me. And I expect people to ask me questions if they know I'm a Christian. And it shouldn't be if they know I'm a Christian, when they know I'm a Christian. I expect them to ask me questions about my faith, about the Bible, about who Jesus is, and about all elements of my faith. And I'm commanded, this is what's called an imperative, you're commanded to be able to give answers to defend your faith in addition to Christianity. So hopefully you get some answers here tonight. If you don't get some answers, either because you're too embarrassed to ask or you're too afraid to ask, we have a website. It's very simple to remember. It's just creation.com. There's now about 14,000 articles on the website. So generally, if you have a question you want to answer, just go to the website, type it in, and if it's not there, email us, and generally we'll answer it for you. On that note, we have an email newsletter. It comes out once about every 4 or 5 weeks. It covers the topic, the main topics that are being talked about, maybe new information or maybe advertisements about where we're giving talks. If you're interested, all you got to do is put your name and your email address on the form. If you're not, just pass it on. If you're already signed up to it, just pass it on round again. So, this is my talk title tonight. It wasn't my own choice of words. It was given to me, and I have formed my talk around the talk title. Hasn't Science Disproved Christianity? And it's an interesting title, I think, for a couple of reasons. And I want to explain to you exactly what I want to do tonight. Because I'm not solely attempting to describe a world in which unguided evolution doesn't work. And I'm not putting forward the simple idea that things are just simply too complex and there's some kind of intelligent designer. That's not the aim of my talk either. My talk is very specific, and it's specific to this question. I'm going to show you that science hasn't disproven Christianity. Because I believe it's the Creator God of the Bible. I believe it's Jesus who is the Creator, not some unknown entity, not some kind of deistic position. I believe that the Bible, and only the Bible, tells you how the world is created, who that Creator is, and what your relationship with him is. So my question tonight is specifically addressing, has science disproved Christianity? Not any other religion, not the notion of a God. Christianity is what we're going to deal with here tonight. Because our God of the Bible is the Creator than the King of this universe. So I'm going to open up with a quote by a guy called Simon Conway Morris. He's in Cambridge University and a paleobiologist. And this is what he said. He says, once you get an idea into your head, it can be incredibly difficult to dynamite it out. Once you get an idea into your head, it can be incredibly difficult to dynamite it out. And there are lots of beliefs in this world today that people really have difficulties trying to dynamite it out of their heads. And there's two I want to deal with at the very, very start. They're both interlinked. One is dinosaurs, and the second is the age of the earth, because they are very much interlinked. The dinosaurs were millions of years ago, therefore the earth is millions of years old. Those two kind of things tie in hand. We went to Walking with Dinosaurs. We took our three kids there back in September, and everything was evolutionary propaganda. Everything was millions of years ago, and those dinosaurs certainly did not live with mankind. So it's promoted everywhere you go, right from the very youngest age, right to the very oldest person in the room. You will get some kind of evolutionary propaganda thrown at you in relation to dinosaurs. Or maybe if you have older children, maybe just yourself, maybe like Jurassic World or Jurassic Park, you'll certainly get lots of that millions of years brought back up. So what do they do with information like this then? If you've been to a creation talk before, I'm sure you've seen this before. This is soft tissue found in a T-Rex femur, published in Science back in 2005. So here we have fresh dinosaur tissue, including heme, and structures which were flexible and resilient, which are supposed to be 65 million years old. What do you do with stuff like that? The same woman, Mary Schweitzer, then she went on to find more dinosaur fresh tissue, including proteins here, collagen, elastin, and laminin. This was supposed to be 80 million years old, and yet still perfectly intact and perfectly fresh. Once again, that was published in Science. And then this is a wee bit later on. This is a different magazine, the Royal Society B Biological Sciences. And this is soft tissue from a triceratops once again. Not only has she found soft tissue and proteins, she's also detected dinosaur DNA. And she did a number of independent tests which confirmed that there were traces of DNA left in the tissue that she was able to examine from dinosaurs. Now, if you've been to a creation talk before, maybe you've seen some of that information before, but what you may not have seen is the personal interviews with the person who found this material. And the personal interviews are a lot more interesting sometimes than the material themselves. Now, the material themselves, she admits, shouldn't be there for that period of time. They should have degraded long ago. They shouldn't be there for maybe a million years, never mind 65 plus million years. The woman who found them is Mary Schweitzer, and this is what she had to say about finding the material the first time she found it. She said, "I had this dinosaur that had just come out of the field. It was a fresh old bone right out of the ground. As I was preparing it, this fossil had an odour to it. It smelled very, very strongly. It smelled like a cadaver, and a cadaver simply is just a dead body. This unique, very sweet odour, decaying, putrid and sweet, that's what my dinosaur smelled like. And so I sat there and I thought, I'm not telling anybody. And I'm working on this bone for 6 months smelling this odour, which means there must be organics present. But of course, everyone knew there cannot be organics in bone this old. An idea that's hard to dynamite out of her head." But she goes on and she explains that she made a choice. But her choice, as you're going to see, is not a scientific choice. So when she's talking about this material, this fresh material inside dinosaur bones, she said, "So that leaves us with two alternatives for interpretation. Either the dinosaurs aren't as old as we think they are, or maybe we don't know exactly how these things got preserved." So she makes a choice about what she fundamentally believes about dinosaurs. She has an idea inside her head, which is so hard to dynamite out, that regardless of what is put in front of her, no matter what she personally, physically discovers, she cannot dynamite that out of her head. And she knows the two choices before, but she makes a choice of the mind. She makes a choice of the heart, and she goes with what she wants to believe, that they are millions of years old. So she says, "I don't know how to explain it. I don't know how they could last that long, but I choose to believe that worldview over the other worldview, which is the more logical one, which says that these things are not millions of years old." There's no science behind that. It's just a choice of the mind, whatever you choose to believe. So she had a presupposition that life evolved for millions of years, that dinosaurs were millions of years ago. So that's what she's going to believe about this tissue, regardless of what she sees before her very own eyes. I'm sure you can all maybe reflect on someone you know who chooses to believe things regardless of what you put in front of them, because it's a battle for the mind or a battle for the heart. But it may come as a shock to you that whenever I put the first one up there, it was 2005, people have known about soft tissue for just under 200 years. I wonder if you've ever really thought about what soft tissue actually is. Soft tissue in these fossils is simply unfossilized material within these fossils that are found. So if we think about cephaloid ink just refers to the ink sacs that we find in cuttlefish or squids or octopus. We've known about this for about 200 years, that there is soft tissue remnants in ink sacs in relation to cephaloids. So let me give you a few examples. This is one from 2009. there were researchers in Lebanon, and they found fossil octopus in limestone in Lebanon. And they were all identifiable there with the insects still intact. And these were remarkably well preserved. The people who found them, whenever they commented about the fossil octopus being found, they said it's about as unlikely as capturing a fossil sneeze. And the reason they said that was because fossil octopuses don't have any hard parts to fossilise. They're just made out of soft parts, maybe apart from the beak. So they're extremely hard to fossilise. Not only did they find one, but they found five in fairly good condition, and all with the insects present. Later that year, they found a sixth one, a slightly different team. This is the fossil that they found all cleaned up. And again, you can see quite clearly it's an octopus, and there is the insect in the top of the octopus there. A couple of years ago, in 2015-2016, they gave a Dutch artist who lives in Norway, a girl called Esther van Poulsen, they took some of that ink material, and she mixed it with water, and then she painted that fossil octopus. And both the fossil octopus and the painting there in the picture to the right-hand side, this is Esther actually drawing it down here, painting it down here, they both hang in Oslo's Natural History Museum. And you can go over and you can see it for yourself. So she simply took the insect, or the remnants of the insect, combined it with water, and was able to paint that octopus. It's not the first time it's been done. A few years prior, in 2009, this is a guy called Dr. Phil Wilby, that's his nose there. He found this here, which is a 3D, so it's preserved in three dimensions, insect from this animal here. So a now extinct type of squid. So it was preserved in three dimensions, and he says that this is 150 million years old. Preserved in limestone in three dimensions. Can you imagine that? How do you preserve a three-dimensional insect over a long period of time? Not physically possible. It has to happen exceptionally quick. So what he did was, once again, he took some of the fossilized insect, he combined it with ammonia, and this is the actual ink from this insect here that then was used to draw this picture here in 2009. So the first one we had was 95 million years old. That was whenever Esther drew that one. This is 150 million years old, supposedly. But both of them stole an idea from a much, much longer period ago. So back in 1826, you had a woman called Mary Anning in the south coast of England, a very famous fossil hunter. And she had a friend called Elizabeth Philpott. And back in 1826, Mary found a fossilised dolomite. And inside the dolomite, she found the ink sac still intact. So she gave it to her friend. She combined it with some ammonia and revivified it. And then she used it to paint lots of famous pictures and write letters with the ink. This one up here on the screen is from 1833. And this is a letter that Elizabeth Philpott sent to Mary Buckland. Using that ink, revivified with water or ammonia. And she wrote letters, she drew pictures, all with what people thought was fossilised ink. But what I want to show you is the ink itself is not fossilised. Now what gives the ink this colour, this black colour, is a pigment called melanin, but a very specific form of it called eumelanin, which gives it the black colour. And this eumelanin is still present in all these fossilised ink sacs because they're not fossilised. This is the original material. So the one on your left that you're looking at, this is the 3D ink sac that was preserved and drew the picture of it. Whenever they zoom up, all these wee round balls, these are the original eumelanin granules. They're not fossil. They're not replaced by minerals. They are the original biological material from the octopus, or these here ones are for squid and cuttlefish. This is the original material. Now, how could that original material last for? The first one was 95, the second was 150, and the one that Elizabeth Philpott was using was 200 million years old. They're saying that that original material hasn't broken down, hasn't decayed, the bones haven't fallen apart, if you want to put it like that, in 200 million years. Regardless of how the Earth has changed shape, how the rock layers may have been subducted and then brought back up, heated and cooled, it's still the original material. And fossilised inside soft-bodied creatures, which shouldn't fossilise in the first place. So no matter what you put before these people, they make a choice. And the choice is they want to believe that these things are millions and millions of years old. And it gets even worse. So this one here I wrote up for Creation Magazine. If you get it, it's the latest magazine. And this is the oldest biological colour that was discovered. And it's not just millions of years old. This is supposed to be 1.1 billion years old. And you'll get it here. This is the key word. This is a biological pigment. This is organic. Okay, so this was created by something alive. And the oldest biological colour, although it's pink here, and this is the original vial where they found this, what they found were called porphyrins. And porphyrins exist within chlorophyll. They're naturally green. But whenever they get buried, there's an ion replacement and they change colour slightly in the ground. And they become this lovely sort of pinky red, purpley colour here instead. This is what they originally would have looked like over here. So those are the oldest biological cover that's now pink. It would originally have been green inside cyanobacteria. So these porphyrins are made biologically. They are organic compounds. And they know for a fact they shouldn't exist 1.1 billion years. We know that because you look at the quotations. So this is part of the people who found it. So you have Dr. Jochen Brox, one of the paper's authors, said when a student discovered the colours, he was initially in a state of disbelief. Why would he be in a state of disbelief? Because they shouldn't be there after 1.1 billion years. He said, I remember I heard screaming in the lab. He said, she came running into my office and said, look at this. And she had this bright pink stuff. Asked how he felt when he realised he had discovered the world's oldest colours, Brock said, my first thought was just, whoa. I was just awestruck that these molecules can survive for such a long time. Now, he didn't challenge the idea that they weren't billions of years old. That was his belief system. That's what he believes about the Earth. And regardless of what you put in front of him, whether it be organic material, which he thinks lasts at 1.1 billion years, he will not choose to change his belief system. Because that's his presupposition. So when we go back to what Simon Conway Morris said, once you get an idea in your head, it can be incredibly difficult to diamond it out. You literally have to change how you view the world around you whenever you look at this information to reassess it differently. Because they have a whole system, a whole structure set up, and regardless of what you put into it, they can make it fit in some way. Even if it's not logical, even if it doesn't make sense, they can still choose to believe these things. So the problem for us is that whenever we go back to our original question about has science disproved Christianity, where is all this information published? Because if you look down the bottom, I put on all the references at the bottom. These are the kind of magazines or journals or publications that you find this information in. And information generally about evolution or dinosaurs or whatever it may be. There's Science, Discover, the Royal Society, Bone, National Geographic or PNAS. You find it in scientific publications. And you find them mixed up with all different kinds of scientific articles about a whole range of stuff, whether it be modern technology or whether it be things from the past. And they're all thrown together in scientific magazines, journals or books. So the thing we have to discuss then is what is science? Because we need to understand what science is to understand what this word actually means. So we have two different types of science. One is operational science. And this is things that are observable, testable, and repeatable. So if I simply throw the remote up in my hand and catch it, what law am I demonstrating? Demonstrating gravity, okay, and we can observe it, we can test it, repeat it. We can do it over and over and over again, and we're going to get exactly the same response, hopefully. But there's a different type of science. And this is the kind of science that we deal with when we talk about the age of the Earth, when we talk about dinosaurs, or we talk about fossils. And in this kind of science, we have some bones in the ground. So a paleontologist will come to those bones, they'll reconstruct them, and they will then tell you a story about what they found in the ground. They'll tell you whether it was male or female, they'll tell you whether it ate meat or ate leaves off a tree, whether it lived in packs or whether it laid eggs. They'll tell you a whole range of things about these animals. Some things may be true and some things may not be. But the difference with this science, very simply, is that we have things in the present, like this fossil here. But the question is, when was it formed? It was formed in the past, but we now have it in the present. And what they need to do is they need to explain what happened to it in the past, so we could now have it in the present. And it's simply they reconstruct it, they tell you a story about it, but nobody was there. It was a one-off, unobservable event that happened in the past that preserved something that we now have in the present. So you don't observe it, you don't test it, and you don't repeat it because it's a one-off event. So it's a totally different type of science. And the thing about this type of science is, and the evolutionary type of science is, that they're both dealing with the past. So does the Bible talk about this type of science? Does the Bible talk about the origin of the earth, the origin of the universe, the origin of rocks, the origin of fossils, the origin of dinosaurs, the origin of life as in plants, the origin of animals, and the origin of humanity? The Bible talks about all those things in the opening chapters of the Bible. So the Bible talks very much about origin science. It talks about cosmology, geology, paleontology, botany, origin of life, biology, zoology, anthropology, and lots more ologies. The thing is, though, does evolution talk about exactly the same ologies? Well, yes, it does. It talks about all those same things that happened in the past, but tries to describe them in a totally different way here in the present. Very simply, we said it was a battle for the mind, and that's exactly what it is. The person on the left, they have a biblical worldview in their mind. That's their computer processor. So when they look at the physical world around them, when they look at things that were preserved in the past that we now have in the present, we extend them from a biblical point of view. And the Bible tells us what happened in the past, and we extrapolate from that to explain why we now have these things like fossils here before us. The person on the right then, who has Darwin in their brain, they look at the world and they extend it from a totally different perspective. They have a presupposition the world was millions of years old, that a Big Bang happened, and that life evolved from a single-celled organism. That's their worldview. So regardless of what you show them, whether it be that dinosaur tissue, whether it be porphyrins, which are 1.1 billion years old, they fit it into that worldview. And even if they can't explain those things right there and then at that time, it just kind of muddies the water for them maybe slightly, but it just fits into their worldview. To give you a real practical example, there's two men on the screen in front of you. Nicholas Steno on the left, he was a biblical creationist. He looked at the world around him and looked specifically at the rocks in Tuscany where he lived, and he described and came up with a strategy stratigraphy whenever he looked at the rocks to describe the layers in relation to the flood that's described in the Bible. The man on the right is Charles Lyell. He wrote a book called The Principles of Geology, which then Charles Darwin took with him in the voyage around the world, and he read them whenever he was going around that voyage. And Charles Lyell looked at the world around him, and he wanted to do something very, very different. And it's there, it's his quote, he wanted to free science from Moses. He wanted to provide an alternative story, an alternative history, to explain the rocks around him in a different way. And if he could do that, if he came up with a different history, a different story, he could remove Christianity's story, Christianity's history, and he could impose his own instead. And that really was the stepping stone that Charles Darwin needed. Charles Darwin needed millions of years for evolution. They were provided in the Principles of Geology by Charles Lyell and people before him as well, who set the stage for Darwin to come. He needed those millions of years. And the atheists are quite honest about it. They don't hide this fact. This is Michael Ruse, he's an atheist, a philosopher, and he said that he's talking about evolution and millions of years. He said it arrived on the scene as a rival to Christian questions about origins. It was not a science versus religion conflict, but a religion versus religion conflict, which is always the bitterest kind. And if you get into conversations with this about people, it can descend into anarchy quite quickly, especially if you're on the internet in the old chat rooms and you're watching other people. It can descend into madness. Because there's big stakes when you're talking about this. Because we're not just talking about whether this fossil is a million years old or not. We're talking about the implications behind it. The implications are, is the Bible true or not? Because if the Bible is true, then there's consequences. There's a gospel, there's a God, there's law, there's judgment to come. All that suddenly creeps in, and all you're doing is talking about a fossil. But the history behind the fossil is the important part, and that's what you're really talking about. Is the evolutionary history true, or is the biblical history true? Because they both have very, very different outcomes. And of course, this is demonstrated, it's still the bitterest kind. This is why you have people like Richard Dawkins, one of the world's foremost atheists. This is just from towards the end of last year. And his next children's book will be specifically aimed to free children from religion. It's still the bitterest argument. It's still a religion versus religion, a worldview versus a worldview. And that's what he wants to do. He wants to impose his worldview upon children and take them away from Christianity. So it's not about evidence. It's not about having a miracle fossil that we can prove creation from, or a miracle fossil you can prove evolution from. Exactly the same fossils, exactly the same evidence, but you view them from two different worldviews, two different histories, two different presuppositions. And those histories, no matter how much you try, you cannot combine them together. They are worlds apart. They are diametrically opposed. You can see there on the screen, one starts about 14 billion years ago with the Big Bang. Starts with the formation then of our sun and earth about 4.6 billion years ago, the formation of life about 3.6 billion years ago, and then evolutionary history from that period right up until now. And in that train of thought, death has always been present. It's been there right from the very existence of the origin of the universe. The Bible's history is very, very different. The Bible says about 6,000 years ago, God created the world over a period of 6 days. At the end of those 6 days, everything was perfect. God blessed his creation, and only after that, after Adam fell in the Garden of Eden, was sin brought into the world, and then death through sin. Two very, very different histories, two very different timelines, 6,000 years as opposed to about 13.7 billion years. The structure's all wrong, the order's all wrong, and obviously the origin of death into the world is a major point of contention between these two ideas. For those who do try and maybe add evolution into the Bible or some aspects of millions of years, this is how I compared it recently in another article I wrote. It's actually from a business book I got the idea from. But if you can imagine a room, and you walk into the room, and the room, everything's connected, interconnected with a series of pulleys and levers. And no matter what you touch in the room, something else moves. And that's exactly what happens with Genesis or the Bible in the middle. Once you start to mess with the age of the earth, once you start to tweak where death maybe crept in, you alter something else. You alter meaning in the New Testament, relation to the gospel, relation to death, relation to sin. So you can't do that. It becomes very, very messy. You jump through what's going to be called theological gymnastics, and you come into a real tiz. And people like Dawkins, who are atheists, they can even see that. They call people like that deluded. Maybe a bad word, but that's what he chooses to call them. So you can't pick and choose what parts of the Bible you believe. The Bible is very, very straightforward. A child can understand Genesis and what it's aiming to teach. An earth which is about 6,000 years old, created by God in six literal 24-hour days. So let's answer some questions in relation to the Bible, in relation to has science disproved Christianity. I'm going to take three broad areas. I'm going to take dinosaurs, then fossils, and then follow it up with living creatures. I could talk very much about almost any topic, but these are the three I've chosen tonight. So if you have any questions afterwards, feel free to ask. So we mentioned dinosaurs at the start. What do evolutionists actually teach about dinosaurs? These are dinosaur facts. They believe that dinosaurs evolved from what's called an archaeosaur, some kind of small lizard-like creature, between 240 and 230 million years ago. This is what they say about themselves, but paleontologists are equally concerned with puzzling out how these mighty beasts got their start. Who were their ancestors? Tracing the origins of the earliest dinosaurs has become a major challenge for paleontologists because there are no uncontested fossils from their earliest days of Earth. Essentially, dinosaurs appear in the fossil record as fully formed dinosaurs, which is a problem for the evolutionists. They contend that they never lived with man, having died out 65 million years ago, and that's whenever they became extinct. Now, lots of people have ideas about what made the dinosaurs go extinct. There are about 65 plus published theories about how dinosaurs became extinct, but there are none of them which actually explain the mechanisms behind it. Some of you may have heard about an asteroid or a meteor that hit the Earth 65 million years ago and magically wiped out the dinosaurs. But nobody actually explains what that meteor did to wipe the dinosaurs out and why so many animals living with the dinosaurs that we have today, like crocodiles or turtles or various birds that were alive at the same time, why they lived and dinosaurs died. So Jack Corner, he's an expert in dinosaurs. He was the expert behind all the Jurassic Park and World films as well. This is what he said in relation to that meteor or asteroid theory. He said, the meteor asteroid theory of extinction is a good example of taking an idea too far. He pointed at just a few dinosaur taxa, so only a few dinosaurs really living around that 65 million year mark anyway. And he said, there's no record of any catastrophic event that correlates with the last of the dinosaurs. He also readily admitted, I don't care, I'm just glad they're gone because I want to go out for walks at night. which is a fair point. I wouldn't want a velociraptor on my heels as I'm walking down towards Temple Patrick either. So they're quite honest about it. And one of the fanciful things about evolutionary theory is how often they get it wrong and how often they need to change it. So earlier this year, I bought a book by one of the top evolutionary dinosaur experts in the world. This is the book here. It was The Rise and Fall of Dinosaurs by Steve Brissetti. He's one of the doctors or professors over in Edinburgh University. It was published in May 2018, and I had it finished by the end of May 2018. And in that book, it said that gigantic dinosaurs, and that's dinosaurs which are over 10 tons in weight, evolved about 170 million years ago. And that gave them a good time frame. They said the dinosaurs evolved about 230 million years ago. They had about 60 million years to get into that gigantic proportions from a small bipedal retriever-sized dinosaur. That's what they thought they were about 230 million years ago. But his book came out in May, and that all changed in July. Because they found a gigantic dinosaur, this one here, Aegyanthea prima, and it was about from 215 million years ago. So they had to do a theory. And this is what the author of this book said in July 2018 when the new dinosaur came out. He said, "I think it's one of the most important dinosaur finds of the last few years. These new fossils force us to rethink when and how dinosaurs got so enormous and tell us dinosaurs were much more adaptable and creative in attaining huge size than we used to think, which I think means there are even bigger and weirder dinosaurs out there remaining to be found." It was a real problem for them because now they have 15 million years to get from these small bipedal retriever-sized dinosaurs into over 10-ton beasts walking in low fours. You have to change everything about the dinosaur. You have to change the centre of mass, how it breathes, all its muscle, its skeleton. Everything has to change in just 15 million years. And they really struggled with this. Now, if you're a creationist, it really doesn't matter because big dinosaurs lived alongside small dinosaurs and they were created in their own individual kinds by God. So it didn't make any great difference to us, but for them it changed their entire story, and they now struggle with their theory of how big dinosaurs came about. So what about the Bible then? Does it say anything about dinosaurs? Well, it does. It tells us very clearly when they were made. The Bible says on day number 6, God said that the earth bring forth different creatures according to their kinds, livestock and creeping things and beasts of the earth according to their kinds. And it was so. So the Bible says, as I'm not working of this, four things very clearly. It says that dinosaurs were created on day number 6, about 6,000 years ago, on the same day as man. Because dinosaurs were, of course, defined as the lizard-like animals with their legs coming down straight from the body. Okay, so they're not like other lizards where their legs come out from the side or the crocodiles. They come straight down from the body and they walk on the earth. It goes on to say that everything was originally created vegetarian. It means that they were on the ark. How do we know that? We know that because we find them in flood layers in which they're buried, which means that they were alive. So if God told Noah to take on two of every kind of animal, it means dinosaurs would have been on the ark. And that means that they were alive after Noah's ark as well with mankind. How did they fit into Noah's ark? Well, very simply, Noah's ark was quite a large structure. It was about 450 feet long, 45 feet high, and 75 feet wide. And of course, the animals, whenever they went on Noah's ark, had one purpose whenever they came off, and that was to reproduce. The largest dinosaur egg that's ever been found is about 61 centimetres in height and about 15 centimetres in diameter. Those are the largest dinosaur eggs ever found, and we wouldn't expect to find dinosaur eggs much bigger than that. Because if they're much bigger than that, the problem with the eggs is the eggshell would have to be incredibly thick. An eggshell has to be able to take air in and get rid of moisture, and it also has to be able to support the weight of the animal. So the bigger the egg you have, the thicker the eggshell, and it simply wouldn't have been able to do its job. So there's a maximum size to eggs, and that's pretty much it. So no matter how big dinosaurs got, whether they were 100 feet or 200 feet long, they started off reasonably small. And if they were going to go into Noah's ark, we take juveniles on, because they have to reproduce after Noah's flood. How do we know they lived with mankind afterwards? Because we have depictions of dinosaurs in every continent apart from Antarctica, ranging from about 4,000 years ago, which is just after that they came off the ark, right up until about 1500. These are some examples for you here. These are ones from China. This is a Centrosaurus. There you can see the jade artifact, which is about 4,000 years old. That's a skull that we find in the ground, and that's a modern reconstruction of a Centrosaurus. Another one from China, also about 4,000 years old. It looks like a juvenile Triceratops. There again is a jade carving that was found in China, the bones that we find in the ground, and a modern reconstruction. This is one of my favourite ones here. This is a wine vessel. This is about 2,800 years ago, once again from China as well. It's a wine vessel. And on the wine vessel, you can see this nice round head, the long neck, the body with the four legs coming down, and the long tail at the end. This is it from a side view, and that's it from head to tail there as well. Something that looks like a sauropod dinosaur, not just any sauropod dinosaur, but looks like a Camarasaurus. Why do I say that? Because there's a nice rounded head on the Camarasaurus, which is what you saw on a nice wine vessel before it. This is one from Mesopotamia as well, also close to about 4,000 years old, and this is a cylinder seal. And on this again, you can see the nice rounded head at the top, the long neck, the body, the four legs coming down, and the tail extending up behind it. Once again, something that looks like a sauropod dinosaur. And you can see that the two necks intertwine. That's the thing that is called necking, which is something that giraffes still do today. And not only do we find these sort of 4,000 years ago, we find them right up in modern times. So this is Bishop Richard Bell's tomb from 1486 over in Carlisle Cathedral. You can go and see it yourself. There's a brass ring around his tomb. This is it here. And around that brass ring, there's a whole range of animals. There's cows and dogs and snakes and sheep and stuff like that. But on it, there are also these two animals here. Just the enhanced view for you there. That's what they look like close up and whenever it's filled in. There again, you can see the nice rounded head, the nice long neck, the body, and the tail here as well. And then once again, they're doing that thing called necking with the two necks intertwining, something that we observe real animals doing today. But it goes beyond that, because it's not just a long neck, long tail animal. It has a very interesting feature as well. This one here has tail spikes coming off it, and these are called phlegomizers. Now, how would they have known to draw tail spikes onto that sauropod dinosaur unless they'd actually seen one? And we know that they existed. We find them in the fossil record. This is a Shunosaurus. This is a long-necked, long-tailed sauropod dinosaur with phlegomizers on the end of the tail. It's a very unique feature. once again, how they've known it unless they saw it. And my good friend, Dennis Domenis, he asked exactly the same question whenever he was in class one day. He said to his teacher, if people weren't around when dinosaurs were, then who drew their pictures? And of course, he says it in jest, but it's exactly spot on. It took us about 50 years to put dinosaurs together properly. To put the skin on the bones, the muscle on the bones, and to put them in the right shape and the right proportions. Some of the early examples of putting dinosaurs together were absolutely horrendous, and they're nothing like dinosaurs that we know today. So if people weren't around, who drew them? Who put them on the rocks? Who described them? And who gave them the exact proportions and sizes that we now know to be true? Who put phlegomizers on them? Unless people saw these animals and really existed alongside them and interacted with them. So it's a good question. And whenever people see things like this, they fit it into their own worldview. Evolutionists dismiss them. They just kind of ignore them. They don't even want to acknowledge them. In fact, there's only one person that I know who wrote a book on it called Carl Sagan. And he said, and this is genuine, it's called Dragons of Eden. He said that the only reason that people drew dinosaurs was because that you have a reptilian brain. And your reptilian brain remembers seeing dinosaurs millions of years ago, and that's where those images came from. That was his... I'm not kidding. You can go read the book yourself. It's a nicely read, covered book called Dragons of Eden. That was his genuine explanation as to how people in the past drew dinosaurs on walls. He was a man of science, apparently. So it was a good question. I've put my propositions forward to you. and the Bible's very, very clear about Noah's Ark and the things that happened around the time of Noah's Ark as well. We talked earlier on very quickly about the dimensions of Noah's Ark. And one thing I would say is, whenever you're trying to replace a history, one thing you can do to the history is denigrate it. You can make fun of it and you can belittle it. And this is exactly what's happened to Noah's Ark. Now, I consider my church to be quite a good church. Some of you here are from my same denomination. But unfortunately, upstairs in our church, in our Sunday school room, we have this monstrosity here. Not Judah, but the ark in front of him. Now, what is that ark meant to be? It's meant to be a representation of Noah's ark. Now, does it look anything comparable to the Noah's ark on the screen here? The box-shaped ark, in the correct proportions and dimensions to the animals, compared to this thing here. But that is the Noah's Ark that is in lots and lots of children's heads. So I got a few opportunities last year to work alongside kids, went to different churches, and as part of my task, what I did was actually had this image, was in the start of my talk, just on the screen behind me, didn't introduce it, didn't speak about Noah's Ark, and one of the first tasks I got the children to do was draw Noah's Ark. Now, what do you think it got 95 to 98% of the time in churches, which would be very strongly evangelical, sound churches in Northern Ireland? What type of ark do you think I got 95 to 98% of the time? Do you think I got the square or the box rectangular shaped one or this thing up on the screen? I got the one on the screen. And whenever I asked the children specifically, where did you get the image from? It was either from their head, from a children's book, from a cartoon, or from the internet. The only ones who said the Bible were the ones who drew the rectangular ark. And this is in denominations that we call evangelical. So goodness knows what the percentage would be in non-evangelical churches. So there's something going horribly wrong. I wrote about it a couple of years ago, and I gave it a brand new word, the cartoonification of Noah's Ark. And that's exactly what happened. We allowed it to become a cartoon, and we put it in books, and we give it to our kids, and that's what they grew up with. They grew up with a cartoon of Noah's Ark. And you can do it, and I challenge you to go home and do it yourself. Google another ship that you know is real and historical, and see if you can find a cartoonified image of it. Go home and try it yourself. You can try it with Titanic, first of all, because I know that there isn't one that exists, or certainly there wasn't when I read the article. You can go home and type in Titanic cartoon. And whenever you get a cartoon picture of Titanic, what you'll see is a fully proportioned boat, an ocean-going liner. It may be drawn in cartoon form, but it has the exact same proportions as it would do if it was placed beside a historical photograph. Why? Because everyone knows what Titanic looks like. They all know it's a big boat with the four funnels that carried lots of passengers and then sank in the middle of the ocean when they hit the iceberg. Everyone knows what it's like. The thing about Noah's Ark is it's described in the Bible too. It's not as if we're guessing at how long it was or how wide it was or how tall it was. It's all there. The size and the dimensions are all in the Bible, and yet people don't use them. They cartoonify it. And that's a great way to get rid of Christianity and a great way to get rid of our history. Make it a cartoon that people don't believe. So if Noah's Ark really happened, if Noah's flood really happened, what would you expect to find? If I click my fingers now and the whole world flooded yet again, you'd expect to find evidence for it. And the Bible makes the claim that 4,500 years ago, that's exactly what God did. God chose to flood the entire world and wipe almost 99% or slightly more of life off the face of the earth. So we expect to find, as the very famous phrase, billions of dead things, bread and rock, air, sky, timber, water, all over the earth. And you know that's exactly what you find. 75 to 85% of the rock that we find on the earth, above the mantle, is sedimentary rock which was laid down by water. And lots of it contains lots and lots of fossils. Evidence of things that were once alive that are now dead. You find a massive graveyard all around the world that shows God's judgment for sin. So were these things formed slowly, or were they formed rapidly in relation to fossils? Just a couple for you to think about. This is one of my favourite ones in Creation Magazine a couple of years ago. This was a fossil, this was a pterosaur, which is a flying reptile. This is the tail, this is the beak with the teeth in it. This is one wing, this is another wing here. And what happened was the pterosaur drove down into a bit of water and took up a fish in its mouth. The fish is still there, it's still stuck in its throat in a fossilised form. And as it was flying back up, this much larger fish here in the spring jumped out of the water, grabbed it by the wing, pulled it back down to the water, and they were both covered by a wave of lime-rich sediment very, very quickly in that fighting position. Didn't form with remains of years over any significant period of time. It had to form very, very quickly. And there's a close-up look at it for you. You can see all the teeth. You can see the teeth of the fish as well. You can see all the scales. They're not disarticulated. They haven't fallen apart. They're perfectly preserved. Even the eye of the fish there as well. Everything perfectly preserved. And if you're interested, we read about things like this in Creation Magazine. It's outside. We can speak to you about it afterwards as well. This is another one in the ocean. This is published in 2015. This was a now extinct form of whale. And this whale was eating a shoal of fish. And it was fossilised in that position. This is the fossil here. This is the real fossil in the corners. And this is what was fossilised. A fossil whale eating a shoal of fish. Once again, it's a snapshot in time. It's not as if the fossil or the whale and all these fish suddenly died together and slowly floated to the bottom of the ocean and were slowly covered in sediment over millions of years. A snapshot in time. So we find lots of animals interacting. This is another one over here. This is 3-in-1. So this is a snake, a fossil snake. And inside the fossil snake, there's a lizard. And inside the lizard, there is a beagle. I'm pretty sure it's a beagle. Take it as a beagle. If it's not, I'll tell you later on. There's a beagle in there. And whenever they found it, this is what they said about it. Most likely it died near the lake and was washed in. But no more than 2 days after eating the lizard, the snake lay dead on the lake floor, entombed in sediments that impeccably preserved it, its meal and its meal's meal. Whenever you look at these things, they know it has to happen exceptionally quickly. But they have a real problem in their mind because they know it formed quickly, but the rocks are supposed to be millions of years old. And they don't really tend to explain it. They just kind of acknowledge the problem. But it's went beyond that. So last year they actually discovered how to make a fossil. So out of all the fossils I put on the screen to you, I can't tell you exactly when they were formed, on what day they were formed, and what hour they were formed, but this one here, I can tell you exactly when it was formed and how long it took. So does anyone want to guess at how long they discovered it takes to form a fossil? This one took 24 hours to form. This is what they said. How to make a fossil in a single day? The recipe calls for fresh feathers or lizard feet, clay, heat, and a whole lot of pressure. So whenever they replicate fossilization in the real world and observe how long it takes, it took them 24 hours to make this lizard foot into a fossil. Interesting. So not only do we know how long fossils take to form, it has to happen very, very quickly, we know that the rocks that they're often containing also have to be formed very, very quickly as well. These are ones you can go and visit yourself. I don't like using things that are always far away. If you want to go to Loch Shinney, Loch Shinney is about halfway between Drumore and Dublin. It's on the coast, and all you need to do is have a Google search of when the tide's out, because when the tide's in, it comes right up to the rocks. And you can go down the beach and you can see these rocks for yourselves and you can go and see the fossils in them as well. Now these rocks, as you can see, in like chevron folds, extend for quite a period along the beach and they're very, very tight. Now it may surprise you that rock can bend, but rock cannot bend like this whenever it becomes solidified. So what we have here is we have rock layers which are laid down, limestone and shale. They were laid down very, very quickly. Very, very flat on top of each other, and then you have some kind of tectonic action which makes them fold when they're wet and they bend into this position. And whenever they bend in this position, you see they're not fractured, they're not broken, they're bent in that position when still wet, and then they dry out, solidify, and become rocks in that shape. And how do we know that it wasn't another agent or another thing acted upon them? How do we know that maybe they weren't superheated up so they could bend and put into that position? But very simply, whenever rocks are superheated, whenever that action is put upon them, they change their chemical structure. So the rock layers that we find in Loch Shinney are shale and they're limestone, and we find fossils in them. So they're not metamorphic rock, they're sedimentary rock. And we know whenever we apply heat and pressure to these types of rock, they change their chemical formation and they become marble and they become slate. And the fossils that are preserved within them, they change as well. So generally you can't see them anymore. And they are, if you want to put it in layman's terms, melted back into the rock. So those rocks that you see in those nice chevron folds had to be laid down wet and then had to be folded in position to then dry out. You won't just see them in Loch Shinney, you'll see them all around the world. Rocks of various degrees of fold and angles there. So we know that the rocks themselves are formed quickly. We know the fossils inside them have to be formed quickly. So that idea that people have that they can't dynamite out of their head that the earth is millions of years old is demonstrably false. It doesn't actually fit with their worldview. The evidence, doesn't fit with their worldview. It's not consistent with their worldview. What it is consistent with is the history in the Bible. Not the history of any random God, the history of the God in the Bible who judged the world with a worldwide flood, which is what we see in the physical world around us. So I said I'd cover one last thing, and that last thing, so we've covered dinosaurs, we've covered their fossils. The last thing I want to cover is living kinds, or created kinds, if you want to put it that way. So There's a picture up on the screen which relates to the living kinds, because God obviously formed the living kinds in the early chapters of Genesis 1 there. And all the created kinds then were taken onto Noah's ark, two by two or seven by seven, whether they were clean or unclean, whenever God went to judge the world. Now, there's something wrong with this picture up here. I wonder if anyone can actually tell me what's wrong with that picture without me telling you. You'll see that picture in lots of books that all the kids get, or adults. Well, dinosaurs are missing, yes, but that's not what's fundamentally wrong with it. Hands up if you think there's a tiger in Noah's Ark. Hands up if you don't know. Okay. Hands up if you think there's a zebra on Noah's Ark. No, there wasn't. So that picture that you see in kids' books, I know what they're trying to do. They're trying to put on cats and they're trying to put on zebras. But tigers and zebras weren't on Noah's Ark. And you need to maybe start thinking about what was on Noah's Ark. Let me explain to you what that means, because I can see some confused faces. Tigers were on Noah's Ark, and zebras were on Noah's Ark, but not as tigers and not as zebras. A cat kind was on Noah's Ark, and a horse kind was on Noah's Ark. Just to make it very simple for you, whenever I was out with those kids last year, this is what we did. We looked at barominology. Barominology, from the Hebrew, bara, created, min is the word for kind in the Bible, and ology is the study of. So barominology is the study of the original created kinds in the Bible. And on the screen for the kids, I put up all these pictures and they put them into groups for me. And on the screen there you have dog kind, the cat kind, the bear kind, and the horse kind. And very simply, we go around the room and they put them into their different kinds for me. Now, none of these animals here were in Noah's Ark, but their ancestor certainly was. There was two of the dog kind, two of the cat kind, two of the bear kind, and two of the horse kind. And all the animals that we have today, different species, if we want to call them that, use a modern word, have descended from those original kinds off Noah's Ark. And all those kinds on the screen are never going to change into another kind, and they have limits within that kind. But that's how God created them. He created kinds in Genesis 1. And those the ancestors, or sorry, the descendants of those original kinds under Noah's Ark, and we have the descendants of the original kinds that were taken onto Noah's Ark then. So what do we mean by that? Well, on Noah's Ark, you would have had something like a wolf-like ancestor for all the dogs. And it's one thing creationists and evolutionists both agree on, that all modern dogs have descended from a wolf-like ancestor. Now, how do you get those? How do you get things like bulldogs, and how do you get things like Great Danes? Well, selective breeding for most kinds of breeds of dogs that we have, because all modern domestic dogs are Canis familiaris, they're all the same species. And Canis lupus, is the species name for the wolves, they all tend to breed. They're all the same kind of animal. So you can still breed a modern wolf, a modern dog. So the top ones are woodles, so that's wolves and poodles. You can still breed them together. The one is a labradoodle. It's an interesting looking animal. But they can also interbreed. They're all the same kind. But you'll never see a dog as small as a mouse, and you'll never see a dog as tall as a giraffe. There are limits to what these kinds can do. And sometimes the changes you see in animals are due to mutations, like the bulldog. The bulldog is a very unfit dog. Most of them can't even be born naturally, and they have the deformation of the jaw, which is due to a mutation, which gives them severe breathing problems. But we like them, so we breed them and we keep them about, and we help them born. They weren't born by cesarean section these days. So dogs have limits, as you can see, they're the Great Dane and Chihuahua, and they will never breed together because of the dimensions of their, the proportions of their bits. but they're still dogs. But they have the extremes. And the same with cats. We have cat kinds. And did you know that your modern domestic cat can breed with a lion? That gets your mind thinking. Now, not directly, okay, so the modern domestic cat doesn't breed with a lion, but through bigger sized animals. So, example, for your domestic cat could breed with a serval, the one on the bottom left here. Serval is just slightly bigger than the modern domestic cat. A serval can breed with a cat slightly bigger than it, and then again, that slightly bigger cat can breed with a lion. All the cats that we can still breed today, apart from the cheetah, which seems to have mutated away and denigrated so much it can't breed with modern cats. So the cats on the screen, these are all interbred. So at the top you have a liger, which is a lion and a tiger. you have a tiger and a lion here called the Tigon. The jag lion obviously is a jaguar and a lion, and the savanna is a serval and a domestic cat. So all the cat kind still interbreeds again today. Same with the bears. How many bears in the ark? Just two bears of bears. That's it. So all the bears on the screen there. So the grizzly bear and the polar bear, whenever they still interbreed, you get a grouler or a pizzly bear, and they're both descendants of the brown bear. So how many bears in the ark? Two bears. And the brown bear, they can still interbreed with pandas. So how many bears in the ark? Just two bears. The same with the horses. That's why I said there's no zebra on the ark. There you go, there's a horse and there you go, a zebra. Right? Now some of the horses, whenever they interbreed, aren't fertile. That's fine, but they're still the same kind of animal. And it would be exactly the same with dinosaurs as well. There's the Ceratopsia. Everyone knows a Triceratops. It's one of the more famous dinosaurs. But a Triceratops is actually a juvenile Torosaurus. A Triceratops is a teenager. A Torosaurus is the older form of it. All the horrid dinosaurs would have interbred as well. Now, there's a really interesting story that came out last year in relation to what we would call species today. And that study, I'm going to put it up on the screen for you and read it out, and then I'll explain to you what it means in relation to what we're studying here today. So, it was called The Recent Origin of Species in our magazine. It was published last year in 2018 in March. And what happened was that researchers, evolutionary researchers, they went around and they studied the DNA barcodes, or mitochondrial DNA, from 5 million different types of species in multicellular life. And they have some very controversial findings. And this is what it said. The researchers concluded that no matter what the organism, human or animal, almost all current populations have expanded from mitochondrial uniformity within the past 200,000 years. Evolutionists, using their own techniques, said that all the species we have in relation to multicellular life arose within the past 200,000 years. That's using their own figures. I'll explain to you why it's wrong in a second. That's using their own figures. They went on to talk about mankind then, and they said the congruence of these fields supports the view that the modern human mitochondrial and Y chromosome originated from conditions that imposed a single sequence on these genetic elements between 100,000 and 200,000 years ago. Contemporary sequence data cannot tell whether mitochondrial and Y chromosomes coloniality occurred at the same time, i.e. consistent with the extreme bottleneck of a founding pair, or starting within a founding population that was stable for tens of thousands of years. To break that down for you, what are they saying about Adam and Eve, essentially, as well? That they, once again, were in the past 200,000 years. Now, evolutionists did not like that study, but it was published by evolutionists in an evolutionary journal, and that's the conclusion they came to, looking at things from their own world view. Now, the reason they come up with these expanded dates of 200,000 years is because they look at the mutation rates in mitochondria from an evolutionary perspective. And whenever you look at them from a real-life perspective, they come significantly down, and I'll explain that in 2 seconds. So we have mankind, then. The Bible is very clear about mankind, that God created male and female in his own image. And whenever we study in the real world, Y chromosome, so male and females, you have definite sex chromosomes. If you're male, your sex chromosomes are XY. Female, your sex chromosomes are XX. And whenever they study the Y chromosome from males all around the world today, they find that all men come back to one man. The same with the females. Whenever they study the mitochondrial Eve, which is a special part of DNA passed on through females, they discovered that all females come back to one woman. So I'm going to combine this all in 2 seconds. So the study in March 2018 said that all life, multicellular, was between 100,000 and 200,000 years ago. We know from studying the Y chromosome and from studying mitochondrial DNA that everyone in the world today comes from one man and one woman. But this is the truth, and this comes back to 1998. It's worth reading out word for word. According to one review of the data, these recent results would mean that mitochondrial Eve lived about 6,500 years ago, a figure clearly incompatible with current theories on human origins. The review in Science's Research News goes still further and eased the date, saying that using the new clocks, you'd be a mere 6,000 years old. The article says about one of the teams, the scientists, that evolutionary studies led them to expect one mutation in 600 generations. This one's talking about they have their own ideas about how long these mutations should take. They were stunned to find 10 base pair changes, which gave them a rate of one mutation every 40 generations. 1 year later, another secular researcher remarked in the study, stating regardless of the cause, evolutionists are most concerned about the effect of faster mutation rate. For example, researchers have calculated the mitochondrial Eve, the woman whose mitochondrial DNA was ancestral to all living people, lived 100,000 to 200,000 years ago in Africa using the new clock, and that new clock was the one that they can actually observe. That's the 10 base pair changes, one mutation every 40 generations. She would be a mere 6,000 years old. So let me put this together for you. You have a study in March 2018 last year which says that all multicellular life arose within the past 200,000 years, which is wildly at odds with evolution, but this is the evolutionist's own study. But what they do is they use a mutation rate that they have set themselves, which doesn't correspond to real life. Using the one they observe in real life today, if you apply that mutation rate to their own set of figures, it comes down to 6,000 years ago. Now that should blow their mind, because that's exactly what the Bible said. That 6,000 years ago, everyone on the planet came from one man and one woman. So has science disproved Christianity? No. Science is totally consistent with Christianity. So we get great variation in mankind as well. Just to give an example, in 2010 that was the tallest man and the smallest man in the world. Great variation. Some of that's due to mutation and degradation of the of what Adam and Eve's genetics would have been like. But God was very clear that the Bible is very clear that both these men are fully human, although some of these things come as mutations of the bad world that we now live in. So the Bible is very, very clear, to sum it all up, that in the beginning, whenever God created this world in which this man and woman lived, in which dinosaurs lived, everything was perfect. Whenever he looked at this world, everything was morally and physically perfect. And that's the God that we worship from the Bible. He's the God of love, the God of that perfect creation. We know that through the actions of Adam in the garden, he brought sin and death into the world. And that's where these two theories, as I said earlier on, are diametrically opposed. And I want you to think very carefully that if you're a Christian, this is why you cannot combine evolution with Christianity ever. Because whenever people ask you about, well, why did so-and-so die? Or, you know, why is there death? The strongest apologetic answer you have is, in relation to God and where death came from, is that man introduced sin into the world, and death came as a punishment for sin. That's where it came from, and that's why we all die, and that's why we're all judged. And that's why the world we live in today is in such a bad state. Because as man was placed as the federal head of the world, a world in which he was given to explore, and a dominion mandate he was given to cultivate and to keep it, it was fitting that that whole creation was cursed at the same time, as a reminder to him of the cursed and fallen state in which he lives in. Now, what does this all mean? Well, it directly relates then to the gospel. Because the Bible is right here, there's a sequence of events that leads to the point where you're at today, that you're in a fallen state and that you need a saviour to come and save you, that there's nothing you can do to get out of the fallen state yourself. And that's effectively where Jesus comes in. The Bible tells us that he came to the world to live a perfect life, to live by the law, and to die on a cross to shed his blood, which is the price for sin. And that's the only way that you can restore that broken relationship with God, which was broken back in the Garden of Eden. But if you have evolution, if you have a world where death has always reigned, there's no such thing as the entrance to sin, and there's no need for Jesus. And don't take my word for it. This is exactly what evolutionists teach. This is Frank Zindler, he's an atheist, and he had the debate with a Christian a couple of years ago. He said the most devastating thing that biology did to Christianity was the discovery of biological evolution. Now that we know that Adam and Eve were never real people, the central myth of Christianity is destroyed. If there never was an Adam and Eve, then there never was an original sin. And if there never was an original sin, then there's no need of salvation. And if there's no need of salvation, then there's no need for a saviour. And I submit that that puts Jesus, historical or otherwise, into the ranks of the unemployed. I think that evolution is the absolute death knell of Christianity. So why do you need to have evolution? Why do you need to have death? Why do you need to have an alternative history? Because then you can do what you want. Then you're not accountable to God. You don't need the gospel. And it's totally irrelevant who Jesus was, because the Bible's wrong at the very, very start. What do? You effectively remove God's ownership of this universe, which is what the Bible says. belongs to him. In Psalm 24:1, it says, "The earth is the Lord's and everything in it, which includes me and you and every single other person who should abide by his law and come under the command of the gospel." Only by doing so will we get to that future world, that future state, where there is no death, where there is no tears, where there is no sadness, and we can reside with God as Christians. So the question posed tonight was, hasn't science disproved Christianity? And I would fundamentally submit to you in closing that no, it hasn't. And everything that you can see in the physical world around you, viewed through the correct lenses, only goes to bolster and show that the Christian faith is totally consistent with the physical world around you, and the people strongly need that Saviour in the Lord Jesus Christ.